This is part one of our campaign of the Between Ghosts of El Paso, currently unnamed, but we will figure that out probably in the near future. This is also technically part two of our multi-campaign anthology exploration of the so-called Brindleverse, as we have kind of decided and been enthusiastic about. If you have not seen the first campaign of White Mountain Rescue Without a Trace, that's okay. You don't need to. There is going to be a reference or two here and there across things. We might get a little more referential as the campaign goes on, but this is largely a standalone story, so don't feel the need to watch a multi, 15 episode actual play of a play tested game just to follow along the story. But if you do want to do that, you should, because it was a lot of fun. We are just going to do usual starting campaign procedure, which is just to say, going to go around, when I call you out, just go ahead and introduce yourself by name and pronouns. I'll start. My name is Alex Rapitsky. I use he, they pronouns. I will be running this game. I am, one of the, heads of the Gauntlet alongside Jason Cordova, and, I co-host the Dark and Threshold podcast, and I like running and writing for these games a whole bunch. So, yeah, that's me. Chaotic, why don't you go?
My name is Chaotic. I use he, they pronouns, and I really like the Between. It was almost a fight about who would run the next campaign, but Alex seems really excited about Ghosts of El Paso, so we're doing that, and I'm excited for it. I've played Ghosts of El Paso once before, so this could be my second time.
Very good. B.
Hello, I'm Binar, they, them, and I'm so excited. I love playing games, especially The Between, which is my first time playing The Between. I love the Brindlewood Bay system. I'm a voice actor by and large. I occasionally write tabletop RPGs with these lovely people, and I'm excited to be a...
Very good. Daniel.
I'm Daniel Qualls. I'm going to be playing... a homebrew playbook called The Calamity, Arkansas McGee, and I am the creator and one of the writers of Ghost of El Paso.
Do you think it is funny that for two campaigns in a row, we have had the creator of said game along for the ride with us? So, yeah, I love that.
To be fair, 90% of CFP games at this point have been created by Daniel.
Yeah, fair enough. And last but not least, Wes.
Howdy, my name's Wes Franks. My pronouns are they, he. And I'm very excited to play Ghosts of El Paso, especially with the creator here. I'm so nervous. Daniel, oh my goodness, I'm starstruck. No, but this is a fantastic. The vibes are immaculate. We're starting off real strong. And for this game, I am going to be portraying Mother Ruth Calvo, whose pronouns are she, her, and she is the lost.
Very good. And if it wasn't mentioned beforehand, Chaotic is playing the Marshal and B, the Inevitable. We will talk more about those playbooks in a moment. We're going to do CATS. CATS is an acronym that stands for Concept, Aim, Tone, and Subject Matter. All of us basically here have already, gone through all the character creation stuff in advance, but we're still going to go through the CATS just for the listener, if you don't know anything about Ghosts of El Paso, and just to remind everybody and set the vibes. And after that, we're going to not really have to go through a lot of the normal procedure. I'm kind of doing things not necessarily out of order, just breaking up the usual presentation a little bit. So you'll see what I mean by that. But the concept is that Between Ghosts of El Paso is a tabletop role-playing game about a group of ghost hunters, the Vigilance Committee, in the township of El Paso, Texas, in the late 19th century after the war, but before the first railroad came through. The Vigilance Committee is dealing with the effects of the Wounded Night, a seasonal phenomenon in El Paso that takes place in the fall every 6 years, during which time the veil between the land of the living and the land of the dead is thinned. The hunters learn about various ghostly threats around El Paso and conduct investigations in order to neutralize them. Over time, they become aware of the plans of a criminal mastermind who is pulling the strings behind the scenes. The hunters will eventually be forced to confront the mastermind in order to save their community. The Between Ghosts of El Paso is inspired by Western films and TV shows such as Deadwood, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, The Quick and the Dead, and Unforgiven. It also takes inspiration from Texas folklore and urban legends, as well as the music of Johnny Cash and other artists. The game's mechanics are based on Apocalypse World, Brindlewood Bay, and The Between. You don't need to know anything about those games before playing, but we all do. The aim of the characters in the story is to keep El Paso safe by investigating ghostly threats and learning how to stop them. Our aim as players is to learn more about these characters' mysterious pasts, as well as to paint a vivid picture of our version of El Paso, a responsibility we all share. The aims for today's session are to introduce our characters, learn the basics of how the game works by playing it, and then debrief at the end. The tone of The Between Ghosts of El Paso is dark, haunted, and gritty. A little bit of levity or humor from time to time is okay, but we will always strive to return to that dark, brooding place the characters exist in. Subject matter: murder, body horror, mind-body control, alcoholism, addiction, war-related trauma, threats to animals and children, foul language, and defiling graves and corpses are all things that can come up in this game. We have talked about safety tools and done our lines and veils in advance, so we will be abiding by that document. It is a living document, so as always, things are subject to being changed by the players at a moment's notice. After all, no game is more important than the people playing it. Now that is all settled, we've already done characters and all the usual higgledy-piggledy of setting the game up. So before we actually jump in and begin, I want to share a few more details about the setting. The first thing you need to understand is the backdrop of this game. The Season of the Wounded Knight, or more simply, the Wounded Knight, is a phenomenon that happens every 6 years in El Paso and lasts from the late part of summer to the early part of winter, and is so named because each night during this period, the moon is blood red, like a bullet hole in the starry sky. During the Wounded Night, the veil between the land of the living and the land of the dead is thinned, and all sorts of strange occurrences take place, not always related to ghosts, but ghosts are the main concern of the player characters. These characters, these hunters, are the Vigilance Committee of El Paso. They have their own motivations and mysterious pasts, but they share the common goal of defending El Paso from the strange events that result from the Wounded Knight. They are a semi-official organization, sometimes operating outside official channels, and sometimes within them. Importantly, the Vigilance Committee was formed because everyone in El Paso remembers the last season of The Wounded Knight 6 years ago and wants to avoid the terrible things that happened then. By the time we join these characters, with the exception of one, they have already been working together for a time. We will not dwell on how they came together as a committee. We might explore that in the game through backstories, who knows? But we are going to just kind of start with this group of familiar cohorts. Another thing to know is that these characters are to remain mysterious. We should avoid talking about their pasts, both in and out of character, unless we are prompted to do so by the game's rules. The reason we do this is to learn more about these characters as we play. Like when you're watching a good TV show and learning about things in flashbacks at dramatically impactful moments in the story. And with that said, we're gonna start. Normally in the session one procedure, we would go through the process of introducing our characters, talking about their, you know, moves and vices and all that fun stuff, and then the rest of us populate their character sheet with some items for their personal items. We are still doing that. We're just not doing that right now. We're also not immediately starting with the introduction of the first threat. We're having more of a cinematic opening to this whole campaign. So yeah. Oh, and as an important reminder before we start, even though this is a game set in a historical time period, we aren't going to dwell on historical accuracy. We'll do our best to represent the technology and culture of the era, but we're going to get things wrong every now and then, and that's okay. I'd also like to point out that during this time period, people with marginalized identities would likely have been treated very poorly in society. We're going to ignore that part of history. In the world of The Between Ghosts of El Paso, things like race, nationality, gender, ethnicity, sexuality, disability, and neurodivergence are not a social barrier. Note that some threats in this game do involve veterans of the Confederacy. They are presented as bad people, and so no worries there. Any questions before we get started? No? All right, then. So, let's begin with the prologue. We see the open desert outside of the township of El Paso. The text on the screen that appears in classic old-timey font simply says prologue, quietus, or death nears the grave. September 22nd, 1881, 5 minutes to midnight. Bartholomew Graves is running from his pursuers. Sweat clings to his cold, pale flesh, biting against the night air of the open desert as a band of shadowy figures follows him from behind, shouting and hollering. There is no moon in the sky. The last fingernail sliver of the waning moon disappeared, leaving just a black hole in the starry expanse. A new moon to most places, but not in El Paso. Not every 6 years. But that hasn't happened yet. Bartholomew Graves stumbles, falling down an escarpment of the Rio Grande, tumbling into the weeds through the dust towards the banks of the wide river. Their pursuers approach. We never see them, just figures in shadow. Bartholomew Graves, dirtied, desperate, looks down the barrel of a gun as one of the figures pulls back the hammer on a revolver, aims the gun at Bartholomew Graves, and pulls the trigger. The gunshot echoes through the night, startling birds echoing past the escarpment over the desert before slowly fading away as it reaches the borders of town. Bartholomew Graves does not feel the gunshot wound, only the sensation of a harsh punch, a tearing, a wetness in his clothes. He's in shock. He won't feel the pain. And slowly, the darkness of night turns to the darkness of unconsciousness, as slowly, Bartholomew Graves begins to bleed out as his captors disappear, or his assailants disappear into the night. The hands of a clock somewhere in town tick to midnight. And in that moment, where there was a black hole in the starry sky, the moon reappears, a swirl of blood-red light that illuminates the full moon like a bullet hole in the sky, casting an unearthly pallor over the land surrounding El Paso. And Bartholomew Graves doesn't quite die. A sharp intake of breath fills his lungs. That's not right. That's wrong. You don't breathe. You can't breathe. You're not supposed to breathe. This isn't right. Where are the seven horns? Where are your siblings? This isn't the time. The seals have not been broken. Where are you? What is going on? And you, death, black out underneath the unnatural red light of a bloody moon. The next morning in El Paso, we begin transitioning to dust motes wandering through a shaft of light through a slightly dirtied window. As we focus first on arguably one of the most important people in the township, Andrew Harrington. The Marshal. Andrew, you've always had a strong sense of right and wrong, but you never let that stop you from doing what you wanted. But then someone got hurt, more than hurt, and the law came after you. You ran. When you made it here, to El Paso, your loved one, the marshal of the town, hid you rather than turning you over to the authorities. You made a better life for yourself, and things were going well until 6 years ago, when the wounded knight took the marshal from you. You don't know why the people of El Paso turned to you, why they asked you to be the new marshal. Maybe it's because they saw how you'd changed, something radiating from inside you, or maybe you were just who was at the hand. In any case, you're the law now, and have been these last 6 years. And now it's time again for the Wounded Knight and the Vigilance Committee. You'll do your best to prevent anyone dying, but if someone must, you hope it might be you this time. Chaotic, could you please introduce the Marshal Andrew Harrington by name, look, tell us about their vice, and present the scene as they awake in their dwelling in El Paso and how they go through the motions of their mourning.
The first thing about Andrew Harrington that you should know is that he has an accent that won't quite get beaten out of him quite yet. So it's honestly, I'm very surprised that not a native of the town such as Wainwright got made sheriff instead of me. But I have short, dirty blonde hair, a maroon velvet vest, and I keep the old marshal's handkerchief in a breast pocket just for luck, comfort. I'm not sure which. I have tastes, and probably one of the reasons I should not have been made the marshal is I have a bit of a kleptomaniac sort of a streak in me. Most folks have a tendency to ignore that. I'm not sure why. Like, even if I do get caught. I think as I am fussing with, like, this sort of household, just getting my things ready, making sure I look all right in the mirror, we can see, like, the mirror itself has been horrendously cracked as though someone had punched it earlier. Opposite side, there is a picture frame that has been sort of, there's been an attempt to repair it, and a picture that has been burned and torn. The figures, like, all their faces have been erased, but, like, the picture is still there. That was the picture of the old marshal's family.
Yeah, you live in the old marshal's residence now.
Yes.
Why do you, regret what you did to that photograph?
Because I came to realize afterwards that was the only picture I had of the old marshal.
Indeed. As the camera pans around Marshal Andrew Harrington's dwelling, what do we see? What items can be found amidst his belongings that might be called for on a moment's notice? Please note that Andrew already has the old marshal's Lamat revolver, already marked, though. I have an idea. I kind of like the idea of you shaving in a broken mirror, so I'm going to say that you have lather and a straight razor.
Outside the window, we can see tied up the marshal's horse, and it is, in fact, the best horse in town.
You have a flask that has an engraving on it on the bottom, and it's quite old. You get to decide what's engraved on it.
Quickly, the camera pans over other various items and then stops on a jar, a glass jar that's tucked behind some other bottles, and we see it's a collection of teeth.
Very good. You happy with those items, Chaotic?
Yes, you won't believe how happy I am with that specifically last item.
Oh, good to
I'm
know.
not telling you why,
Don't
but I'm
expect
not.
to. Chaotic has hinted that their character has some connections to another campaign, so I'm also excited to learn about that. Very good. As Marshal Harrington steps out of his dwelling into the township of Old Paso proper and begins to walk through the town, we cut away to another figure entirely, similarly waking up in the bleary morning light, although under probably worse circumstances. We go now to the Calamity himself, Arkansas McGee. Some would call you an uncouth, foul-mouthed, cantankerous excuse for a cowpoke, and if they do, they got it half right. In your defense, they probably just met you on a bad day. You've lived most of your life on the trail and in the company of like-minded rough-and-tumble folk. You've been a wagoneer, sidekick, army scout, trail guide, cattle rustler, gunslinger, and everything in between. You were once best friends with the greatest gunfighter you ever did meet, Blackheart Vermilion. After their murder, you tried to move on, but little things keep reminding you of their death. You found that alcohol is just about the only thing that keeps you from ending things on your own accord. You like visiting El Paso, mainly because the town still holds you in somewhat high regard because you once helped stop a bank robber, but mostly because Blackheart liked El Paso. However, the town don't know the real reason you are here during the Wounded Knight, but you do. How do we first see Arkansas McGee in the morning
We hear
light?
like a banging, and outside the window we see Hutchinson's blacksmith in livery, so we know it's like a blacksmith hammering like some horseshoes or something. But the hammering is making at some point is making Arkansas just like groan, and he's in a small, soiled, scrabby looking bed, and he's rolling over slowly, waking up and holding his head. He's missing a tooth, but not really, because he keeps it in his pocket. He's got a canteen next to the bed. It's from the 1845 Mexican War, and it's filled with moonshine. He's still wearing his matching buckskin pants and jacket that he hunted, kilt, skinned, and made his own self. As he slowly starts setting up. His vice is target shooting at the sky. So
Very
target practice.
funny.
He's not going to do that this morning because he can't. He can't, he's clearly hungover, and he slowly sets up and looks at his small room. It's in the it's in a brothel at the edge of town, and it's called the boarding house with a blue tin roof. Prostitution is legal. The woman who owns it, she likes to pretend that it's a boarding house for wayward women, and so he's got a job as kind of a handyman. He fixes some things around. He takes out the trash. He escorts patrons and prostitutes back and forth to different places. That's what he does to earn his keep. He does have on next to. The canteen. He has this framed picture, much like the marshal does, except this one's is in pristine condition, and it is of a striking woman, with a noble demeanor, and she's got this long black hair, and she's wearing a black looks like a black leather trench coat, and it's tooled with what looks like roses of a different color, but we can't tell in this black and white photograph. And we can't see now, but on the back it says, there's written on the back of the photograph, it says, "To Arkansas, my dearest friend, with warmest regards and admiration, Blackheart Vermilion."
I think we hear another knock, this time coming actually on the window frame itself. I think Marshal Harrington, on your walk through town, you check in to see if Arkansas is in fact up and awake and not too dreadfully hungover. So Arkansas, you see the marshal's face peering through the window, rapping against the glass.
Stop that. Please stop that. Stop that.
And
I'm
you
begging
see
you, Marshall, stop it.
Marshall, contented that he is in fact awake and conscious, or lucid, I should say, you go on your way in Arkansas. You go about your morning tasks. As we pan around his small room in the back of a brothel, what can be found in Arkansas McGee's personal quarters?
An old bloody deck of playing cards that Blackheart Vermilion won off of a another person that she was in a gunfight with.
A gun that you really shouldn't have.
You're able to write this however you want to, Daniel, so it fits. But you have a copy of Beatles' dime novels of the United States of America. It costs one dime. It is the choicest works of the most popular authors. This copy is Myleska, the Indian Wife of the White Hunter by Mrs. Anne S. Stevens. That is from Irwin P. Beadle and Company, 141 William Street. So it's a dime Western novel. But in it, there is a bullet that was caught that was meant for you, but was stopped.
I think, those are all really great. Now I have to follow that act. Let's see. I think you have your trusty trapper's knife for skinning things. Good. And we see the old cantankerous bastard himself start getting ready for the day. And we cut over once again to meet with Mother Ruth Calvo, the lost. You were a true believer once. You were called to help the wounded during the war between the states, but the horrors of that war shook your faith, left you with questions and doubts. You came out west, but you're just going through the motions of being a religious leader. Every day you feel the sting of your own hypocrisy like you're an imposter. And every day, you dull the pain. Each Sunday at your prayer tent on the edge of El Paso, you take a few coins from the collection plate to eke out an existence. The Vigilance Committee approached you because of your strong faith. They think you can help them with the strange happenings associated with this so-called wounded knight. You're not so sure, but you can't tell them that. We will open on your dwelling as well. Not your prayer tent, just the house of another, because someone with more faith than you currently houses you as their form of offering to the church. How do they make you feel like an imposter in small ways every day, and why do you suspect they get a small measure of pleasure from making you feel like an imposter? Set the scene for us.
We see Ruth in a nightgown in a small twin bed, if you can call it a bed, as the sun rays shine across her face. She has sharp cheekbones, weathered face, but she's not unattractive. She's just old. She has wispy white hair that she collects into a tight, full bun when she wakes up in the morning. There's somebody honking a horn outside. There are Spartan furniture in this room. It is a tiny, almost closet in the back of a house. She immediately gets up and puts on a black dress that has a high collar that goes all the way up to her neck, sleeves that go all the way to her hands. She puts a cross necklace on. She takes it off every time she comes home and she's not around others, but she puts it back on. She tries to creep out of the room. It's towards the back, towards where all the kitchen area of this house is. But it's always to no avail. There's always a small child or one of the folk cooking in the kitchen.
Oh, you muted.
This is the home of the, let me get the name here. Oh God, where's my dwelling at? Where is this? The Wilson family. They are a group of Mormons that took in Ruth after her incident. They consistently rub their familial bonds in Ruth's face to show her that she is not like them. They do not go to any Mormon function or church because there is no formal Mormon function or church in the town of El Paso. They've all been run out of the states around towards where they will eventually settle in Utah. But Ruth stays with them, and they come and worship under Ruth because they need a place to worship and gather. But every morning they sit around the table. She is not allowed to sit at the table. Well, not allowed. They just have a space for her set by a window. It's off in the corner with its own chair, a tiny little table that has a modest wooden bowl and spoon where she can look upon and see them all gathering together like a family praying together. They ask her to pray most mornings, though sometimes she does sneak out before them. Other times she doesn't come home. But this morning she does. And she gives us modest, silent prayer over their food and looks towards her bowl of oats and a few blueberries and begins to dine.
We don't pan around this space. We cut to later after breakfast when Mother Ruth, you're walking through the streets of El Paso to go towards your prayer tent. You can see the old burned down Methodist church down across the way, looming in the distance, ever present reminder of broken faith. It burned down before you arrived here, but all the same, it haunts you. As you step into your prayer tent, we pan around the space. What do we find to populate Mother Ruth's personal quarters?
A dead soldier's love letter from the war. It's not for you.
There's a worn, leather-bound King James version of the Bible, except for it's not. It's actually a box that's got a hidden compartment in it. It's just made to look like a Bible.
I'm gonna copy something right over from the previous campaign of El Paso I ran because I like the item too much. Let me ask you though, Wes, is Mother Ruth a drinker?
When it's convenient.
Yeah. You have a communion chalice that reeks of whiskey.
You have a letter from Marshall Harrington that contains various confessions of things that he thinks he did or is associated with him. And at the end of it is, if you ever need a favor from me, just ask and I will do it, no questions asked.
You happy with those items, Wes?
That's a powerful item right there, absolutely.
And indeed, conveniently enough, as we see Mother Ruth going about her morning preparations in the prayer tent, Marshall Harrington, you're passing by on the street. How do you, from afar, greet one another?
I nod my head towards Mother Ruth, and you see this look of guilt on his face. Even though he has confessed his sins, it's still not good enough.
Good morning, Marshall. How'd it goes for you today?
It goes still quiet here, thankfully. How is it today, Mother Ruth? Everything quiet here as well?
Too quiet this morning, but that's okay. It seems that though it is quiet outside, there's a lot of ruckus inside of your brain. Have you come to talk more?
I suppose there's no hurt in talking more. Maybe this time my thoughts will get out of my brain.
Mother Ruth unfurls a banner that says, "His wrathful embrace, church and revival, confessions daily, please give," and hangs it up where it normally goes behind the pulpit. And she looks, "Shall we be taken this like the Catholics, a private confession, or is it okay to sit in a pew right here?"
It's all right to sit in the pew right here. I don't think people would understand what I'm confessing.
She stops, turns, dusts off one of the pews, and sits quietly, very like straight backed, no sign of hunch or anything, very aware of her posture, and pats the seat next to her.
I think as Marshall Harrington sits next to you, I think we, in this sort of outside light, we get a better look at him. His posture is hunched over as though he's trying to hide himself from you, sort of cowering almost, but not of you, but of like what he's afraid you represent, which is holy divinity. But he seems awfully young for being in like El Paso for at least a decade so far. Must be just good luck in that regard.
Shall we begin with a prayer then? She clasps her hands together, looks at you to do the same, and bows her head. Dear Heavenly Father, please bring together us this day, this morning, in beautiful El Paso. Let this day, though it might have its share of challenges and hurdles, bring forward to us new light and appreciation for the beauty that you give us. Let us know that though we have transgressions upon us and we deliver transgressions upon those around us, that that is not who we are, but who that we strive to move past. Let the dear Marshal here bring about justice in the town with a swift and mighty vengeance, but a dutiful eye to understand the justice that he wields. She's going to open her eyes and look at him while he may, and just like take in his whole figure. Let the marshal know that each morning when he arises and he shines, that your light has come for him, and that the glory of the Lord rises upon him as well. And let him not carry too much weight in his heart. For thee that we pray to, in thy ever-loving name. Amen.
Amen.
Unburden yourself unto me.
Think we cut away from that scene. Marshall Harrington approaching your office. Let's talk about the marshals. Kind of like a building here in El Paso. Paint us, not necessarily not a paint the scene question, just kind of paint us a picture here, chaotic, about what you envision about where you operate out of and like what you see as you walk in through the door.
Yeah, I think the Marshall's place of residence is a sort of mesa building, a sort of like of clay and whatnot, one story. Like it does like have an office where the Marshall takes all of his work, but like the first thing like you see when you enter is like a series of cells just to make sure like any sort of roughhousers gets their due and make sure that El Paso stays safe and make sure that they don't hurt each other, because like you don't want to like a bunch of people all in one cell.
You know.
But there is that
he's one here cell. Again. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's here again. There's that one cell that every morning is occupied, even though you keep releasing him. Del Sol, as he calls himself, is laying on his back in the cell. He is covered in tattoos of suns and other celestial bodies. And you know that no one else in town, except for you, can see or hear him. He gives a two-fingered salute from his position laying down as you enter, and just says, "Morning, Marshall."
"Morning, Delso. What did you get up to last night that got you thrown into here?"
"Oh, I didn't get thrown into here, Mr. Harrington. I simply entered on my own accord. I figured best to sleep it off than suffer the worst of it free on the streets. You know how it is. Ripples and eddies tearing at my soul."
"Of course, of course. But you could do with some self-improvement instead of harboring that drink and whatnot."
"Oh, I drink deep of a particular well. I'm aware of my own vices, Marshall. Worry not, I'm just letting the worst of it pass me by. Figured it's safer to sleep it off than to fall ever deeper down that well of oblivion. But I won't harry you much longer. Hope you don't mind my return."
"I don't mind. It's better that you're in here rather than causing trouble. At least you have that amount of self-awareness."
"Oh, the amount of self-awareness I contain within myself is in fact vast and multitudinous, Marshall. Every man has their vices, and every vice claims its due, and mine is a particularly harsh mistress."
There, Delso. Sleep it off."
I will. He leans back and lies on the cot in the cell, closing his eyes, humming a song faintly that just you can't place, but it's one of those songs that just feels so fucking familiar. Mm-hmm. Wainwright's not in. That's not necessarily out of the ordinary. Sometimes that your deputy is out doing other things and he'll come around eventually. Mm-hmm. Del Sol whistles at one point, breaking the hum, kind of giving this like low and piercing tune that quivers with a distinct vibrato. And he kind of sits back up on his cot and like looks at you. "You a man of letters, Marshall Harrington?"
"Yes."
You read the classics? You been to the theater?"
"It's been a while, but I used to.
"Macbeth, Act 4, Scene 1. By the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way comes." And at that moment, you hear some shouts of a clamor and activity coming down the street somewhere in El Paso. Mm-hmm. We cut away. And we see a group of people are carrying the bloodied and unconscious body of Bartholomew Graves, mad and mumbling with fever, carrying him to a home. Someone fetches Doc Albers, the town's physician, and they bring him to the house. Word quickly spreads to each of the other members of the Vigilance Committee that one of your fellow Vigilance Committee members, Bartholomew Graves, was found early this morning in a pool of his own blood, bleeding out by the banks of the Rio Grande, seemingly shot and mad with fever. What do you all do?
I have to go out and go see because you can't have random gunfights out in El Paso. Even if he does, Graves does survive, it's still I have to go investigate this.
Go ahead.
You go ahead. Go for it.
So when one of the boarders at the boarding house, the Blue Tin Roof, tells Arkansas McGee when he's sitting on the porch pulling up his boots, when she tells him, he's like, "What, Graves?" And he immediately pulls out his gun and checks how many bullets are in it. And he's like, "Okay, what me? I got all my bullets." And he's like, I gotta go, honey. See how this fella is. He's on the vigilance committee with me. I don't know if you." And then he just kind of wanders off towards the doctors.
Oh, Lord. I'll sit over him. Sit with him, make sure that nothing troubles the soul as it passes.
We find the three of you in Graves' dwelling in El Paso, alongside Doc Albers, town's physician and pharmacist, as well as some other practices. If anyone here has watched Deadwood, this is exactly Brad Dourif's character from Deadwood visually. He's got round wire spectacles, graying hair, and wears a brown suit with a black tie. Currently, we find him with a pair of forceps, having pulled the bullet that he found out of Graves' shirt, kind of pulled open, tending to him, looking at the gunshot wound, and remarking, "Well, it ain't the worst I've seen. I do think he'll survive, but..." He looks over at you, Marshall, Mother Ruth and Arkansas, and says, "Frankly speaking, he might be a bit, delirious. This man is starving. He's barely eaten, presumably, in the last several days. He's gonna... If he does recover, it's gonna be very uncomfortable for him."
Well, he hasn't been in town for several days, so this stands record. I wonder what he was out doing in the desert.
Well, if I had to take a guess, it would simply be that his penchant with manipulating the hand of fate at the gambling tables may have caught up to him. But that's just my... That's just my opinion, not a professional one.
Is your opinion to be given about someone that is on death's door having to talk about their transgressions in the past have anything to do with their health now?
I didn't mean anything by it, Mother Ruth. Calm yourself. I do not wish to start a fight. All I'm saying is we need to be well aware that someone made an attempt on his life and might again attempt it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see.
The good news here, the silver lining that I see clearly before us is that's a real bullet, ain't it, Doc? That ain't no ghost bullet. So at least we know it wasn't nothing supernatural that got him, and on account of the oncoming troubles.
Oh, the troubles aren't oncoming, Mr. McGee. They are here, didn't you know? The autumnal equinox has passed us by. The first moon rose last night. Wounded Knight is here.
I mean, potentially. Like, we're right on the edge. It's coming.
Right. Sure, yeah.
But this is a real bullet, ain't it, Doc?
It's a real bullet, Arkansas.
It's... Why don't you put it in your mouth like you've done before, Arkansas, Mr. McGee? Find out if it's real bullet or a ghost bullet now.
No, you can just touch it. A ghost bullet's, like, intangible.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't that refreshing that you understand the qualities of a real bullet as opposed to a ghost bullet? Lord, forgive us that we may not understand your wisdom that you provide to us.
Oh, it pays to know.
Yeah, metallurgy is one of my enthusiasms. I do think there might be some concern if you want to, you know, have me take a look at that bullet. I could possibly discern if there's any irregularities in its composition. We don't want anything, any potentially lethal metals leaking into his blood. Like I said, the situation's, it's complicated enough. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's perfectly fine. I found Mother Ruth, I know that we should not speak ill of both those who are wounded and those who are dead, but it's important for at least my business to know how because we can't have someone go around just shooting people because of any sorts of ill will transgressions. I know that is an important thing to recompense, but however, even still, no one deserves to die for it.
Well, mayhaps one of you good and kind, smart folks may let me know where I be needed over this poor man. Pray for his soul so that he may pass on. Or mayhaps I should go investigate with ye. Would ye need something? Maybe someone with a eye, a penchant for the understanding the evildoer's heart around you. Mayhaps you leave me with Mr. McGee. I might help him find some solace that does not require the bottom of a glass to find.
Hey, is Graves coherent?
Graves is barely lucid, mad with fever. B, what sort of mumblings might they be able to intuit in that occasionally escape your lips?
I think, unless Mr. Harrington and Mr. McGee are very familiar with revelations, Ruth might be the only one who recognizes the some of the words that come out, and specifically Revelations 6:8. And I looked and saw him, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death, and hell followed with him. And you hear things that are from this book of the Bible that I imagine, Ruth, you probably don't read much. Things about horns and swords and death and beasts of the earth. And the occasional, and you all recognize this sort of aghast to be here. Insisting that this isn't right. Something isn't right. Maybe you can write this off as the fact that he's been shot in the chest and he's still breathing.
If you could also be so kind, B, as to describe what Graves looks like.
Like shit right now, but other than that, brown cattleman hat. Usually he's got a toothpick in his mouth. He fiddles with things all the time. If it's not a toothpick, it's dice. Maybe weighted cards, maybe marked. And right now, an unusually pale complexion, maybe the blood loss. He's not exactly the, he's not an outdoorsy type.
Ruth is going to take Grace's hand and say, now, quit all that belly aching. There's no need to be talking of hell and Pell Riders. You're near enough, though, in El Paso.
I think that Graves looks at her a little bit. Lucid's a strong word here. He's like, of everyone here, you should know about Pale Riders.
I'll not be taking that talk from you, all right, Sonny? You do not be talking to me about what I do in my personal time. I'm gonna go ahead and just put a little bit of force on Graves to like make it uncomfortable and stand up and says, nowhere near death. Mayhaps you might mean to make a confession, but when you come to me for that, you come correct.
I think we see Doc Albers kind of like puts a hand on your back, mother, and says, now, leave him be, like I said, mad with fever. Just, he's gonna need plenty of water, a proper meal, small bites. Don't want him to get any stomach spasms or cramps. Might even worsen his condition. Now, if I might have a word with the three of you outside, kind of like nodding his head to the front door. And three of you step out. As lucidity blooms in your mind, what are some of your first thoughts coherently as you're roused from your delirious state, the one who is apparently called Graves?
Well, shit. That's the first thought.
Mm-hmm.
The second is, this is sure. At first, I thought maybe this was some sort of dream. I don't dream, but maybe I was just imagining things. No, this is very real. This is the most solid I've ever felt. And why the hell am I bleeding on a bed here? And why am I of everywhere, El Paso?
That's a fun little question, ain't it? Why are you here? How are you here? Who are you? The Pale Rider? The Grim Reaper? Death? You are the physical manifestation of the only certainty in this world. You know who and what you are, but you do not know why you are here in this weak mortal form, your host, a body. You must protect at all costs. The seals on the scroll have not been broken. You are not here for your final true purpose, and yet, here you stand. You wonder what other beings lurk on this earth that do not belong. You must send them back and get back yourself. This town, with its sinister glow visible only to you, is the work of something truly evil, perhaps even the devil himself. But why here? Why now? Perhaps this vigilance committee, this group of hunters your host was a part of, can help. In any case, you are, and you are in El Paso. You find yourself in the host's house. What gives away their last name? How do you know what they do for a living? What do you find that dismays you?
I imagine I've been addressed by my host's name. And also, before I forget, Kerok did mention in the chat, Graves is wearing gloves. He's always got gloves on. They're these fine, a little, maybe a little too fine leather gloves for his station. We don't know where he got them. But there is a telegram from a distant city sitting on a table nearby, addressing unpaid debts, addressed only to Graves. Hanging up nearby, there are sleeve garters and an apron that reek of alcohol. And nearby them, there's a set of dice and cards. And I know instinctively they're loaded and marked.
Panning around the space, what items does the inevitable have for their personal quarters?
In a brown box, wooden box, when you open it up, it's got this thin metal frame. It's I don't know, like 6 inches long. And we see a lot of springs and things. And at the end of it is a two-shot derringer. And there's two of these spring-loaded derringers that can go up Graves' sleeves.
Graves, no. Death. You try to crawl out of this body, try to like separate it, but it doesn't work. So you try to call forth any power that you have had since then, and your knowledge of those who are meant to die, the ones that you're meant to take, it manifests in this world as a little black book.
You've got a rosary made of black onyx. Upon it, there are four charms. One has a skull and crossbones. One has a sword. The other one has what appears to look like a capsule that has something within it. And the other is a bug. It looks like it could be like a flea or a locust or something.
I got something that's very indulgent to us. Your vice is chess, right? Not Graves the host, but like death. Your vice is chess.
Yes.
Cool. I think you will find in Graves's house, just maybe like in a drawer or rolled under a bed somewhere, a single king piece from a chess set. It's unique. because it looks like it's made out of copper, though now it is old and covered in a patina of green verdigris.
I love it.
Very good. As you get accustomed to the space, out on the porch, Doc Albers is speaking with you when, yet again, in this godforsaken, busy town, there's currently a stir happening as the Deputy Marshal, Dudley Wainwright, just stumbled back into town. And we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will introduce our threat and begin play proper. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Right, we are going to begin the day phase proper by introducing our first threat, the Lady in White. Deputy Wainwright reports a strange occurrence. A supply wagon rolled off the side of Foothills Road just outside of town, killing the two drivers, Clive Barnes and Jose Morena, and all four horses pulling it. The wagon tracks indicate it veered suddenly off the road. The deputy claims he saw a woman dressed in white while he was collecting the bodies. She was standing up by the road near where the wagon went over the edge. He called out to get her attention, but she simply turned and walked away. It's his impression that she was heading toward the old Carson homestead. Wainwright can't recall how long he stood on the spot watching her, nor can he remember when he started moving, but at some point he found himself walking down Main Street, sweating and shaking in the cool morning air. A question for Graves. A particular detail in the deputy's story confirms that the Lady in White is a ghost. What is it?
The air around her was very, very cold, and he felt cold every time he looked at her.
Good. The question, the only question on the Lady in White, is how can we get the Lady in White to pass on to the next world? It's a complexity 6 question. Answering that will allow you to resolve the threat by performing a quieting ritual. And so with the start of our day phase proper, let's hear what y'all want to do today. Starting with Mother Ruth, what do you want to do today? You're muted.
Sorry, my push to talk wasn't working. Let's see here. With that in mind, Mother Ruth wants to... I guess the best thing would either talk to Wainwright, but if somebody else is going to do that, probably start heading towards the old Carson homestead to get like an idea of like where... that kind, like just the area around that to get it like a sense of feeling of what's going on, or if this is something that Wainwright's just off the weed or something like that.
Marshall Harrington, what are you thinking about doing today?
Second pair of bodies, second injured with this ghost. I'm just curious whether or not it's related to the incident with Graves, because with one corpse, it's often at times that it's got to be related somehow. So I'm going to try to talk to Graves about this, mm-hmm. and probably send out Wainwright's to probably get some more points of investigation, figure out like if anyone else was planning on like getting supplies or anything of that nature, because like with wagons coming in and out of town, there's got to be someone who has to have, like, a destination in mind, so.
Mm-hmm. What about Arkansas?
Are the bodies of the guys in the wagon, are they still up there, or have they been brought somewhere?
I think that in the time since, like, Deputy Wainwright stumbled back into town, it was probably within the marshal's oversight to have somebody go retrieve the bodies all the same, since he was getting them loaded up anyway. So I think the bodies are in town, and they're at the makeshift mortuary that's beneath Doc Albers' pharmacy to kind of like stay there until, you know, not the horses, obviously just the of the two drivers. The horses, you know, they're dealing with the carcasses otherwise, but yeah.
That sounds like a good dark place for Arkansas to be. And so he will go check out the bodies, because he's heard of this Lady of White across the Southwest, and he wants to confirm something.
Yeah, I love that. And then, yeah, Graves, in your new and curious existence, for the viewers or listeners, however you indulge yourself with the show, I approached B with a crazy little idea of starting the game with full conditions as opposed to just deaths or the inevitables, normal one permanent condition of death touch. I also started Graves with starving and gunshot wound, fittingly enough. So you're stacked up in a bad place. So with all this fun stuff in mind, what does Graves want to do today, B?
Well, it sounds like Mr. Harrington is going to talk to Graves.
We can start
And
with that, yeah.
so we're going to start with that because I think Graves is just sort of acclimating.
Very good. Let's start with that scene then. Marshall Harrington, your pick of where we're going to start this scene. Is it in Graves' home or is it elsewhere in El Paso? What are you thinking?
Probably in Graves's home
All
because,
right.
like, that's like where Graves has been sent to rest and recuperate.
Right. This can just as easily count as the vulnerable move,
Of course,
as
yay.
per the game's rules as usual. So as long as one of you is indulging in the vice during the scene, that's all fine and good. But otherwise, I'm very excited to see how this scene plays out. So both of you, if you'd be so kind, please set the scene and then just role play.
I think Graves, you hear Harrington making his way back into your home where you've been moved to. Sort of stopping every few paces. You're not sure what he's doing. And then he enters the home, sort of a hand in his pocket, looking a little bit smug about something.
Huh.
You're awake now, Mr. Graves?
And you've walked in on Graves, sitting actually at the terrible little dining room setup. It's very, this is a cramped small space, but he's up and around, weirdly enough, and doesn't really seem suspicious of you at all, regardless of how long you took to get here or how smug you seem. And he's fiddling with chess pieces. Yes, I am. And what are you do you need something from me?
It's more or less that you've been away as of late, and just wondering why that is.
I've been otherwise occupied.
Sure, Mr. Graves. I don't care particularly why you've been away, whether or not it's running away from debts or anything of that nature. I'm just wondering if you saw anything unusual in the desert, sort of a who may have shot you, any sort of occurrences, because, well, frankly, the Wounded Knight has begun, and you may have seen some sort of a ghost or two.
Oh, there's ghosts everywhere. Mr.
It's a Marshall Harrington.
Of course. Marshall. So.
The good doctor said that this may have come up, but so really hope you remember something, anything.
Alex. Do
I
I
will.
remember anything?
I'm going to say you don't remember things, but you have the awareness of the hosts like within you, I think. Because I
Okay.
know that some of your masks and stuff involves like from the host's perspective. So I'm going to say you don't have the host's memories, but how do you feel the host's consciousness within you sharing the same body, even though you're in the driver's seat?
it's like having a fucked up Jiminy Cricket, a little bit of maybe not words so much as feelings in the sort of clawing at the back of your head, almost intrusive thoughts occasionally that are just completely detached from death themselves. And Graves pauses and really thinks about it and then shakes his head. No, there's. I apologize. I don't believe I do. I'm sure there are other ways I can assist you, Marshall, other than just. I don't. Did you mention a lady in white?
Yes, there is presumably a ghost, the first ghost of the season, wandering out in the hills.
And what does this have to do with this? Was that related?
Maybe not. It's
Interesting.
but you were in the area last night, so.
I was. Huh. Well, I can't help you here, but I'm perfectly fine, and I think I can help you elsewhere with this. Maybe we could go talk to her or something.
Maybe. You feeling all right, Mr. Graves? Feeling up to this?
I'm not sure I've ever felt like this. It's really interesting.
Yeah. I think from the host's perspective, like, I think you get the sense of feeling a little bit of annoyance, especially with like Mr. Harrington's hand in his pocket. Because
That's yeah, that's and he looks a little bit. Marshall, why don't you take a seat?
All right.
Did you just you don't have to be so formal. You don't have to stand there with your hands in your pockets or hide things from me.
Of course, we all have our little petty vices, and I take out a handful of loaded dice. I figured that these may have gotten you into far too much trouble.
You know what? I think they do. Why don't you keep them? I don't need those. And for the record, that's batshit insane coming from this dude. Like, not correct at all.
Yeah, I think during this entire scene, Mr. Harrington has like his sort of hairs like been standing on the back of his neck, and he like one of the reasons why Marshall, instead of taking care of normal business like Dudley does, is that he knows like when supernatural things are afoot, but he doesn't know what up is up with you right now.
Go ahead, keep them. They're yours now.
Very generous of you, Mr. Graves.
Of course, there's no need to steal. We're friends, aren't we?
I would say so, but even friends can steal from one another, bad vices and all, but we don't get mad at each other.
I don't imagine that that's the case always. You, I mean, come on. You're only human. You all get mad at each other, right? I don't care, though. That's, you can keep them. I would rather help you other places than this. But you can keep all of the loaded dice you can put in your pockets. I don't care.
I think
Hey, yeah, it was a go ahead.
I think the vulnerable move gets
Yes.
triggered because it's my vice.
Yeah, petty theft. Yeah.
Yes.
I will invite Graves to ask me a question about my past.
Ooh, that is fabulous.
Very fitting for the moment, yeah.
When did you pick up this vice, Mr. Harrington?
Oh, I suppose that's a fair question to ask for blatant theft.
Should get better at it.
I don't think I will.
Tragic.
Not really. It's more or less that I can always get away with it. People don't seem to get that all that angry with me, when, even if I do reprehensible things. And this is like harmless in the long scheme of things. I think I've had this since I was from childhood, honestly speaking. My mother said that whenever I saw something that I wanted, I would just take it. She often said that was just like my father.
Fascinating.
In
It's not unlike most people.
incredible. I like that scene a whole bunch. What condition do you think you've cleared here, B?
That's a really good question.
Considering that the good doctor like patched you up.
Yeah, I think that maybe we could, I don't know, but that's kind of a big one. I'm not going to say I can clear gunshot wound unless Alex really.
If you're angling to clear gunshot wound, like I think I see an argument for it, because I don't
Yeah.
see how you could clear starving because you haven't eaten, you know.
No, I have not eaten.
So in that case, I think you could, I mean, oh, I should be clear, you don't have to clear a condition if you don't
No.
feel like it's justified to clear it, but I think I could see an argument for clearing gunshot wound, but it's up to you.
Okay. I didn't want to just say I could clear a gunshot wound, but I would like to.
Yeah, I think it's just as easy as saying the fact that since the doctor tended to you, now you're up and in chatting, it's like you can kind of like acclimate to the wound to kind of like
Yeah.
it's not as much of a hindrance to you. So yeah, you can clear
Yeah.
that. Very
Yeah.
good.
It doesn't remove that you have a gunshot wound. It
No.
just removes the hindrance, like you've
Yeah.
been bandaged up. It's like having a broken arm. Like you can clear the condition, but like your arm is still like in a sling.
Let's cut over to follow Arkansas McGee, having gone to the makeshift mortuary in the deep basement of Albers and Company Pharmacy. It's cool enough to store bodies in for a few days and quite dark. So this is where the two carriage drivers have been brought to after recovered from the foothills road. Let's paint the scene about this makeshift mortuary. How do you know this place is haunted?
Is Doc Albers walking down with me?
He can be if you want him to.
So as Doc and I are walking down the stairs, I hear like a whispering sound, and I say, "What? What? What'd you say, Doc?" And then he's like, "I didn't say anything." And then, but I keep hearing like a whispering.
Mr. Harrington refuses to go into the mortuary. He says that there's too many eyes on him down there.
It seems that when there's crucifixes or any kind of like iconography to kind of give it a little bit more like respectful feeling in this place, they fall often and you have to replace them. You have to put them back on the wall, but they keep falling and you can hear the clatter.
And sometimes the hands of the bodies seem to move too. They'll spontaneously sort of fall, even though they've been balanced perfectly on their chest. It's really odd.
So the bodies of Clive Barnes and Jose Morena, broken from being thrown from the wagon, bodies suitably damaged, have been placed down here. What are you doing, Arkansas? Oh, you're muted.
He's having the doc hold the lantern, and he's like looking at the bodies, and he's talking to the doctor, and he's like, "It's really common. This lady in white is a common phenomenon throughout the Southwest. You probably heard it, Doc. And it's always the same. It's a ghost of this woman that's, and they're trying to communicate to us great sadness. And sometimes they leave signs at the wreck, or where they walk, or on these bodies. That's what I'm looking for, and that's my move, Ghost Stories, where I add a wants possession of a clue pertaining to the phenomenon. And this is the ghost is trying to communicate a great sadness.
Oh, all right. Well, you go ahead and add that to your list of clues. It's a fun little move. You can do that once per session. Not bad. I like that. Doc Albert is just kind of like gives a single nod and says,
"Is that so? Well, I'm not familiar with the tales myself, but are you all right if I just set the lantern here on the side? I have customers to mind upstairs, you see."
No, don't leave me down here alone. This place has got the raw head and bloody bones sneaking around. You just hold the light, and I'm just going to go through these guys, and I need you as a witness so that you can see that I'm not robbing these poor fellers.
Let's do the day move to convince Doc Albers to stay with you in the dark basement. What are you, I feel like it's obvious, but what are you afraid of happening here if he doesn't?
I'm afraid that he'll leave and then the voices will stop whispering and start they'll be more audible.
I like that. It is going to be a roll plus presence. I think you being hungover is going to give you disadvantage. You kind of got like this brusqueness to you, an edge.
I do have something that I can use as a ward.
Yeah,
I'm pulling out this old bloody deck of playing cards that Blackheart won in a fair fight, and I'm hoping the blood of defeated enemies will help ward off he's going through it real fast. He picks out the ace of spades and he's like, "Yeah, let's do this." So I'm doing a flat. What was the stat?
Presence.
Okay. 4, 5, 6, 7.
So on a 7, I will tell you how your actions would leave you vulnerable, and you can choose to back down or go through with it. And if you go through with it, I will describe what it looks like. I'll come back to you. Cutting over outside of El Paso to the Foothills Road, since I believe, Mother Ruth Calvo, you were intending to head up out into the Foothills to pay a visit to the Carson homestead? All right, good.
That is correct.
The Foothills Road is a dusty trail marked with a few wagon ruts cut into the packed earth. Looming to the north are the Franklin Mountains. You get a pretty good view of El Paso as it ascends up to its highest points. Let's paint the scene. The road is twisty and treacherous as it enters the foothills. Looking around, how do you know others have lost their lives on this road over the years?
White rocks dot alongside the roadway as markers.
There's a lot of these twisted trees that almost look like driftwood, and no matter what time of year it is, you can always see a couple of vultures just sitting up there waiting.
I think down past the road where people usually fall, there actually are scattered bones, sun bleached.
You don't travel on these roads when it rains. You stay in town. Everyone knows that.
To get to the Carson homestead, you know that you'd pass near the site of the wagon wreckage without needing to cross it directly per se, but you do see other people are out here up by that spot. A wagon is parked kind of near where the bend where the wagon, where the, you know, the wagon wreckage site is, several feet off of the trail. And a woman is sat at the head of this wagon, and various other like local children are moving about. Some of them are like walking into the wagon wreckage, grabbing like boxes and like helping lug them back to the cart. What do you do?
Morning.
As you approach, you recognize this figure. The woman seated on the wagon is B. Tessa Schuster, a woman with a relatively small build wearing working clothes. Her first name is Bertha, but she gets real mean if you use that. She prefers to go by B or BT, B Schuster, however you want to present it. Or Tessa. She came to El Paso to start a business, and her partner, Lucia Ortiz, they manage the largest general store in town. So you're familiar with her, to some degree. And, she holds up a hand and says, morning, Mother Calvo.
Morning, B. You, collecting or are you, looting?
Collecting. The wagon that wrecked? Well, it was carrying supplies for our establishment, trying to salvage what we can of, what we ordered.
Anything perishable? Did you hear about this from anyone, or did you have to come and find it yourself?
Well, I heard about it from the buzz about town when the deputy marshal came back in. Heard that the wagon crashed and knew that it was from the company that Lucia and I were expecting a supply from today. And, well, came out to check it out myself. It's not hard to find up on the Foothills Road.
Sorry you have to come and lug it yourself, especially when you're paying for a service such as that, but I reckon you don't have to pay the ferryman either for this service. You're having to do it yourself.
Oh no! I do give the kid some payment for their services. They are helpful for the most part.
Well, that's good of you, though. I know that the hard work and character that they're building is payment enough for them until they get to a rightful age where they can earn their own finances.
Indeed, indeed.
Might I ask you a question?
Shoot.
Some of the more eccentric types back in town are thinking about that it might be something nefarious that caused the wreckage here. I'm thinking that there might be something a bit more material about it. What might you say is the supplies that they were carrying?
You can go ahead and roll the information move plus presence, Mother Calvo.
Bone dice. Let's go, baby. That's a 9.
It's a 9. Keep cool with complication. Very good. Take a look at my clue list here. About something nefarious, about supplies that were being transported, correct?
That is correct.
Let's see. Tessa says,
well, I only know what Lucia and I ordered. I mean, that's what we're picking through, trying to salvage as much as we can. Feel free to take a look at the wreckage yourself. I saw some blood stains over part of the wreckage over there. I didn't figure that may have been where one of the bodies landed, so I don't have the kids poking around there too much. But I mean, I didn't see anything personally, and they haven't mentioned it, but if you want to go check it out, you're more than welcome to. That is your complication, is you'll need to actually, like, go into the wagon wreckage and, like, look around to find that actual clue, so to see it, like, up close and experience it. And she says, I mean, look, hey, I don't really know what I can tell you. Just overall, more bad luck and a long string of bad luck. But, hey, Mother, if you got a minute, if you pitch in, I'll make it worth your while. But Claudia, stop playing with that and get it on my cart! And get your good-for-nothing brother off there before he hurts himself. Remember the deal. Your pick of penny candy if you actually help.
Sorry about that, Mother Calvo. Hey, if you don't mind lending a hand, I can do you better than Penny Candy.
I think I can. My old bones aren't so old yet, so I might be able to lend a hand. You mind if I speak with the children real quick, though?
Be my guest, but I'm hoping to get back to town very soon, so hopefully you don't distract them too much.
Only just a quick parcel of words for them. We'll see if they actually stick, though. You know how children be.
He just gives a nod.
Just going to loom over these children. Ruth is tall. Bird-like, almost. Sad but beautiful face, but, like, has, like, sharp bones and is about 5'7 to 5'9 for a woman and skinny. Keeps her arms close to her body, stands close, does not have a wide stance at all, so almost looks like a black post with a, like, a white mess of, like, hair on top. Goes over to the children and stands. What be your names?
Several of the children give you their names. You have Claudia, there's Robert, there's Josiah, Ezekiel, all sorts of different names for local youngins.
I have a charge for you. People believe that blessed are the meek, and the meek shall inherit the earth, and that meek begins with the children. That be you. You'll be growing soon. And though the night is coming upon us, where it shall be fearful outside, your heart to stay strong and steadfast. Now listen to me, you Hellions. When that woman make offer to you for candy, for you to do a job well done, make sure you do that job well done. For I fear the wrath of the Lord might fall upon you if you don't listen. For what is one of the commandments? Honor thy mother and father. Is that not true?
Are you invoking fire and brimstone?
I am invoking fire and brimstone on these children.
Would you care to read
the
move
them out? Into shape to do this job for me, essentially.
Read that move out for us, please.
So fire and brimstone is an additional move for the lost. Then the Lord rained brimstone and fire out of the heavens. When you encounter a person or group doing something that violates your moral code, children not acting how they should be, you may point out the errors of their ways with an impassioned speech. If you do so, roll with presence or sensitivity, your choice. On a 10+, they disperse and or are regretful. On a 7-9, they stand down but are resentful. On a 6-, their heart is hardened and they lash out.
Love that. So go ahead and roll with either presence or sensitivity.
With sensitivity, it's a 12.
Fantastic. Just tell us a little bit about how you strike the fear of God into these children's hearts.
I think it's convenient, almost as if Mother Ruth picked out the right spot to stand in. So as the sun is moving overhead, as it's starting to move towards zenith, as we get towards noontime, the shadow just casts on her that falls over these children. And I think that this stand post, she has like a looming presence over them. And it's not like a fire and brimstone for Mother Ruth when speaking with like children or those that might be meek or more enfeebled is not fiery, passionate yelling. It is stark, concise, quiet even, so that it sticks with you. You have to pay attention to listen to what she's saying to you. And I think for a moment you can see some of these children fidgeting amongst themselves and kind of like bumping into each other. But as the more words she says, and she says, the night's coming and everything, we see these kids start to like, their eyes widen. They stop fidgeting with themselves. They stop spitting and they're just looking. And I think you can just hear a murmur of like a, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Like, just like, just coming, muttering from them. And then Mother Ruth goes, I didn't hear you rascals. And they all say, yes, ma'am, Mother Calvo. And she goes, they're good. Clear it out. And if you see anything interesting, there might be something in it for you. Bring it to me.
Sure. I love the idea that they can disperse and finish up their gig swift enough to
as to get out of the immediate vicinity, along with B as well, who will, you know, the kids finish up their gig with a renewed zeal to get the job done as quickly as possible and get the heck out of there to be good little kids. So you will have the scene to yourself. They don't bring you anything per se, but they do point you directly into the direction of where the bloodstains are for you to follow up on in a moment. Let's jump back over to Arkansas for a quick second so I can tell you the result of your move. I think with a 7-9, here's how you're going to be vulnerable. If you're pressing Doc Albers to stay down here with the light, you're going to take the condition marked by Doc Albers because he's going to be a little bit like frustrated and irate with you because he's basically having to like babysit a fully grown man down here who you can see is like visibly scared. So he's going to get something, he's going to have some frustration thrown your way. So if you continue to press him, then that's what you'll take. Is that what you do?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right.
He does not want to be down here by himself.
All right. Take marked by Doc Albers as a condition. And he just gives like his lips purse into a thin line as his hands tighten around the handle on the lantern. He just gives you like a single nod, his face half in shadow, but the other bit illuminated by the lantern light. As he just with a little creak moves the lantern over the bodies to help illuminate the scene for you. What do you do?
He's going through like their pockets and looking at their faces and their hands and stuff. He's checking them out. I'm gonna do an investigation roll. But as he's doing it, he's talking to the doc. He said, "Hey, doc, you said this morning at Graves you suspected he might have gotten shot for what'd you say, for the way he plays cards or something like that, or his debts?"
I mean, it's merely speculation. All I know is that Mr. Graves is no stranger to rigging the game in favor of the house.
Where's he playing these days?
You'd have to ask Graves. I don't know. I'm not a gambling man.
How'd you know about it? Where did you hear he plays at?
I heard it around town. You'd listen to a few words as well if your ear was anywhere but the bottom of the well of your own sorrow, drinking yourself to death.
That is true. That is a valid point. But I'm trying to see about where he's been playing cards. And if I'm asking about town, you are, in fact, a man about town. Ah, what do we have here?
I will actually ask B for the host's thoughts on this, because I'm curious what sort, because you had told me that he does gigs as like a bar, he's done like bartending and like manages like gambling tables. What sort of like venues do you think Graves was working at? Like nicer, middling, shitty places? What was Graves generally kind of working at?
Middling, largely with a, I imagine it might be Neil's. Kind of place, a place with that's maybe not fully reputable, but it's not like the roughest place, because I don't think Graves can handle himself in a really rough place.
Okay, then sure, we can say it's Neil's Saloon on Santa Fe Street. He can say that's where he last heard as to where Bartholomew was setting up working tables for someone.
What's he's got in his nasty pockets is?
Yeah, very good. Go ahead and roll the information move plus reason. Also, again, disadvantage because of hangover, because your mental faculties are clouded by the regret of drinking.
Reason is straight up 7. Straight up 7.
Straight up 7. All right, we'll get back to that. After the vulnerable scene between Graves and Marshall Harrington, what are the two of you looking to do with the rest of your day phase?
Marshall Harrington, do you have, I'm going to defer to you first.
I am going to say, like, frankly, I don't want you, Graves, to wander too far out of town since you're not doing so well. Probably pick up with Dudley to see, like, what he's been sort of investigating in town. I myself have some leads to handle, private affairs, you understand, to hear Graves.
Of course you do. Now I'll follow up with who do I follow up with again?
Deputy Wainwright, Dudley.
Yes.
Yeah.
Him. I'll go do that. You take care of your personal affairs, and Try to keep your hands to yourself, Mr. Harrington.
Where are you going, Marshall?
I'm gonna go see Del Sol.
Oh, very good. Very good. Then that would take you roughly to the same place. However, Marshall Harrington will be off into the cells while Mr. Graves here is meeting with the deputy sheriff in one of the kind of like, you know, main little spaces he probably has a desk at. And we'll go to that here in a moment. Let's start with Graves going to the marshal's office to meet with Dudley, the deputy marshal. He's an excitable, earnest gentleman, older than he looks or even acts. He is wearing an obviously polished deputy badge fixed to his brown vest. For most everyone else around here, and maybe as the host can whisper here as well, most folks in El Paso tend to mistake him for his brother, Jonathan. He's currently seated at his desk. He has like a cup of coffee that he's poured from the kettle. He still looks a little pale. His hands have a slight tremor to them, but he has this kind of, despite it all, like smile on his face, just kind of taking the edge off, clearly rattled by whatever happened this morning. As he's pouring himself some coffee, he holds up the kettle to you and says, I don't rightly recall, Mr. Graves, do you drink coffee?
Yes, please, actually. That would be...
Oh, no, absolutely.
Interesting.
Oh, yes, happy to help. Pardon any grounds that might be mixed into it. I'm afraid that my brother's a lot better at the mixing of drinks and such like than I am, but he pours some coffee into a little like camp cup for you and sets that across from me on the other side of the desk and says, he kind of fumbles around and grabs a chair from the other side of the room and like brings it over to offer you a place to sit directly right by him.
Right beside him, I love it. Not across. He's so friendly. For a second, Graves is kind of fascinated with the taste of coffee. Like, he has to stop himself, to not get distracted by it, because it is ostensibly the second thing he's ever tasted, the first being blood.
Here's a fun question. Do you immediately burn your tongue?
Yes.
Amazing.
Instantly.
Amazing.
Instantly. I had no idea this was hot. I didn't even know what that meant. but after kind of doing a poor job of recovering from that, what for a regular person would be kind of embarrassing, he turns to the deputy. I've come to ask you about the situation from this morning.
Oh, you're talking about what happened up on the Foothills Road when I came back into town. Boy, that was some kind of accident. I've never seen a body mangled like that. I don't mind telling you this, but I don't think I can ever ride in a wagon ever again. I mean, look, for God's sake, my hands are still trembling.
How unfortunate.
Most indeed. I feel terrible about not just the drivers, but those poor horses. Terrible, terrible affair.
It happens, but could you tell me? Oh, all the time. But
I need to keep my eyes out on the horizon more often than not. I tend to see the best in El Paso and the people here. I understand that life can be hard and that things happen, but sheesh, such an accident.
Could you tell me what caused it?
I mean, well, as I understand it, the wagon veered off the road. Pretty dangerous up there. It ran off and... Well, it got thrown all about, horses tumbling one over another in their reins and the hitchings and breaking their necks, and the drivers got thrown mighty far, and, well, Mr. Morena's leg was bent the opposite way backwards, and Clive's head was twisted, another direction that I didn't think was entirely too natural. But it seems like they had a gnarly accident. But if you're asking as to... the nature of the affair.
He takes a little audible gulp and seems to kind of know what you're angling towards with his report of thinking he saw a woman dressed in white before, losing time. Why don't you go ahead and roll the information move plus your presence.
Yeah, I'm not. You don't have a disadvantage here.
All right, I don't got any presents either.
You don't.
That is an 11, though.
Oh, very good.
Flat roll.
Ooh. Very good. I will give you a clue. Let's see what we got. What does Dudley Wainwright tell you? Ha ha ha. Hmm.
Dudley says, well, I don't know as to what could have caused it. That woman I saw, it might be nothing nefarious. I understand this wounded knight business might be bringing all sorts of things. I mean, Lord knows I have my own experiences with the unnatural in some degree, one or another. Most of us do. I don't need to tell you that, Mr. Graves. You and I have exchanged many, many conversations on the subject before. But, well, I feel like those roads may be extra treacherous lately. You hear about the fog up on the Foothills Road?
No, I don't believe I did.
I only caught a little bit of it, but I've heard most of it from other folks lately, just that there's been fog recently up on the Foothills Road, but not any that's coming off of the river, just a fog that's been obfuscating the trails out there. I mean, definitely makes it a little bit more treacherous on those bends. If you're not really paying attention, you can easily, you know, trip a shoe, snap an axle, go veering off and get all sorts tangled up like those poor two did. So that's your clue. Recent fog on the Foothills Road, but not from the river.
Thank you, Deputy. That's very helpful.
Happy to be of help, Graves. Might I say, I heard you had a predicament of your own, and you are looking, you are looking spry for a fellow who was shot, so I commend you on your bravery and inner strength, sir.
Thank you. I'm not sure that's either the case, but I appreciate it nonetheless.
Oh, well, all right. If you don't mind, I gotta down this cup of coffee real quick before I attend to a couple other affairs for Marshall Harrington. I got a, you know, busy day and can't just stop the train for one thing. Not that there are any trains around these parts yet anyway, but you know what I mean.
Of course. And by the way, Graves does just fucking chug the coffee. Like, even if it's still super hot, like, it's almost food adjacent, and it's the first food adjacent thing he's had, and just absolutely fucking chugs it before he leaves the cup.
Very good. Let's go back to Mother Calbo. After the wagon departs, you are lingering around the wagon wreckage, you said? Very good. Yeah, this part of the road has severe erosion, roughly patched with chunks of rock. No wonder this accident was as bad as it was. Other factors notwithstanding, these tracks sharply veer off of the road into the dirt filled with muddy rainwater, and there are just goods scattered about that haven't, the ones that weren't picked up and reclaimed by B and her enlisted children have been left out here into the elements. So let's paint the scene, everyone. What evidence of a ghostly presence remains here, even in daylight?
A little bit of that unnatural fog just sort of hanging low.
Light shining through a broken, the spokes of a broken wagon wheel look like the rib cage of like a dead man. The shadows look like a rib cage of a dead man.
The sun is unbearing and unyielding, and it burns in the sky, but near the sight, it is frigid cold.
We see sort of like as like sort of like not from like the looking at this sort of wreckage, but away from the wreckage as though someone is currently watching it. this sense of being watched is just very heavily present here.
What are you doing, Mother Calvo?
Couldn't have one of those menfolk come out here and lend a hand to old Mother Calvo, but I suppose they have their own needs to be met around here. Nothing but shame. Going to take the skirt of the dress, the hem, and tie it up, making sure that no menfolk are around, tie it up around her knees, and then start clambering inside of the wagon, starting to investigate it, and pointing at, going to investigate those areas where the children pointed out might be of interest.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead and roll another information move plus reason here.
That's an 8.
An 8. I'm going to say that we're going to trigger the day move on account of the fact that the wagon wreckage is particularly gnarly. You could easily hurt yourself by climbing around the interior of the wagon wreckage itself. So go ahead. This is going to be plus composure sounds like the right move here in the fiction, even though it's, you know, not no different than vitality. Go ahead and roll. What are you afraid of happening here?
I'm afraid I'm going to get the tetanus if I touch a nail or something like that. It's not the wounds that kill you. It's the infections out here.
All right, go ahead and roll.
It's 4.
Okay. So indeed, as you are picking through the twisted wreckage of the crashed wagon, there is indeed a nail that is juts out from part of the twisted wreckage that catches on the edge of your forearm and drags and tears a deep line in your arm. The blood immediately blossoms out and dribbles down your forearm into the black fabric of your dress. You feel just this sharp pain running through your arm. And indeed, you can take the condition. It's not quite infected. It's not already infected, but like, you know, I'm going to say infected wound, you know, is like this, like tear, like, you know, and you know, from the arm.
That'd be nice. I am going to go ahead and put on a mask, though, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I want to beat the rest of these cunts to it, and I want to put on the Gilded Door so I can get Most Beloved.
Right out of the gate, session one.
Right out of the gate, baby. I'm a pick-me bitch. Mother Ruth Calvo's a pick-me, so there you go.
Fascinating. Love to see that. Go ahead and take the permanent condition, Most Beloved. Incredible. Swap one condition for the other. That'll bump your result from a miss to a 7 to 9. I'll let you know how your actions will leave you vulnerable, and then you can choose to continue to explore the wagon. This was the day move. Yeah, that's right. I owe you a clue from the wagon, and then we just resolve the day move. That's what we're doing. That's right. And I owe you another clue from previous because you're investigating it. Stacking them up. Good job. I think instead of such an immediate, like, you know, my immediate thought was like, oh, season one of The Walking Dead, for anyone who remembers, like the dude who like cuts his arm on like the jagged like metal car door and that like gnarly wound. That was kind of like what I was thinking of like originally. I think here you just get a lot of, you're going to get a lot of splinters if you go poking about that. So you won't take infected wound, but I am going to... I'm not going to give you a condition. It's just that I think that it's going to take time. You know, like, you already, like, walked up here. You didn't bring a wagon out here. Picking through this site takes a lot of time. By the, you know, the day's taken away with you spending so much time up here. So that'll be the your complication instead. Do you want to go through with that and still investigate through the wagon?
Yes, because the damn men folk going off and playing grab ass with each other. I'm going to be spending all of my day looking around in this wreckage.
Very good. then I'll go ahead and give you the clue that you'll find poking around the area as you rolled. And then you said you're going to go check out the site where the other children pointed out. So we'll get to that. First, the clue from the wreckage. Let's see here. Are you looking out for anything in particular? Tell me a little bit about how you're searching. Like, what do we see Ruth doing on the scene?
Ruth is not fully convinced that it's truly, like, ghastly stuff. Like, Ruth understands that spirits move and everything like that, but is trying to find if there's any outside interference or influence with the wreckage.
Sure. I'll tell you, this works quite well. You notice that one of the front wagon wheels was broken with great unusual violence, not just veering off of a road, breaking an axle and, you know, cracking the wheel just from force. Like, this wheel almost like, it's like someone like threw a stick of dynamite at it, or just someone just ran a train through it. It's just like busted and fucked up. You notice that just wood and splinters and, you know, spokes of the wheel just scattered around the site. One of, like, the actual, like, spokes, it's not, like, just, like, you know, it didn't, like, just, like, fly away. It, like, it's, like, stuck in the ground. Like, it, like this wheel burst with such great violence that it flung a spoke and it just, you know, like a javelin, just embedded itself in the dirt, like, dozens of, like, meters away. Now, following up on the clue that you wanted to take another closer look at, there is indeed a trail of blood splatters that are off to the side that lead away from the immediate wreckage site, a small, thin trail of blood that go towards some, like, shrub brush that's some scrub brush off to the side. How is Mother Calvo feeling right now?
Watched?
Take the condition feeling watched. As you approach it, the first thing you see is a livestock cage, about, you know, the typical thing that you'd see people transport, like, chickens in. It's dented and misshapen, and the actual little hatch door to this little mini coop is, like, ripped open, not with unusual force, just like someone, like, you know, it was bent out of shape and, like, somebody clearly opened it back up. Just it took a little bit more force than would be normally necessary. And the chicken is still inside of it, but the source of the blood is that this chicken has been decapitated and you don't see the head anywhere nearby. That's your clue. Let's cut away. Back to Arkansas for a moment before we join the marshal. The clue I owe you, with a complication. You said you're rifling through their pockets?
Their hands, their facial features. And as I'm doing it, I'm saying to the doc, I know you don't like come. I know you city slickers don't like to come down and see this kinds of violence brought upon others, but this is what this is like another day in the life. I just need you to hold a light, doc.
He grumbles something.
You've got soft hands, Doc. I'm just saying.
He grumbles something else. Here's your clue. Then I'll give you the complication. These are badly mangled bodies. Probably maybe some of the worst you've even seen. But on both of them, in one of their kind of like clenched and twisted hands, so there's just in their clothes, you find fresh rose petals.
This is just weird, Doc. Look, I thought it was blood. It ain't blood. It's rose petals.
Now, as your complication, Arkansas, let's see. The makeshift mortuary was already pretty cold, but it feels suddenly and drastically colder. Doc Albers hasn't seemed to notice, but you're pretty sure you can see your breath fogging out in front of you. That's how cold this place feels. A cold like the worst winter you've ever encountered, with no blanket or shelter from its wrath reaching into your bones. Doc Albers kind of looks at you with a queer expression on his face, as if he's expecting some kind of episode from you. I'm going to have it be the night move. What are you afraid of happening here?
I think I'm going to spend it. I'm going to use a mass.
Oh, all right.
Bump that. So you want to still do the night move, or do you want to?
No, if you're bumping it up, you would bump it up to a 10. So that would, there would be no complication. So instead, I think we just.
So if it's getting cold and it's starting to, like, the hairs are starting to stand out on the back of his neck, I think he stands up and is like, let's get out of here, Doc. Let's get out of here.
Mm-hmm. You see yourself
I'll
out.
I'll mark him after the past.
Very good. Do you want to narrate that now, or do you want to wait?
Oh, I think it's a short one. It is, where's the hunters? It's a short one, because it's the very first mask of the past, which is narrate a flashback to your earliest childhood memory as a child. And as he's going, it's dark, right? And I just got the light and I can't see, but his earliest memory as a child is in Virginia in like 1830, and just the green hills and the farmlands and the trees. He's never been back to Virginia, and he's never seen anything that green before. But right now, coming up out of this cellar, that's a morgue, he wishes he was there more than anywhere else.
Very good. Marshall Harrington, visiting Del Sol. Care to read your move out loud formally for us all?
Yes. There is a man who is always in the town's jail cell. You keep releasing him, but he always shows back up to sleep it off. He calls himself Del Sol. He is covered in tattoos of suns and other celestial bodies. No one else in town, including other hunters, can see or hear him. Additionally, much like your own past, you can never speak of him. Each time you have a scene with him, describe how his appearance reflects what you have revealed as a result of the mask of the past. Del Sol can be consulted like any other side character. When you do so, roll with sensitivity. On a 7 to 9, gain 1 clue. He will reveal it in a way that reflects his current disposition. On 10 plus, as above, but you gain 2 clues. The keeper determines Del Sol's disposition based on what you have marked on the mask of the future.
Good to know.
And because the Gilded Door got marked by Ruth Calvo, that limits my moves a little bit. Unfortunately. Yep.
That's all right.
I'm saying it.
Yeah. How do you approach Del Sol?
I think as Graves is going and talking to Deputy Wainwright, I think, like, we see sort of like from that earlier somewhat friendly disposition, I think we see like a sort of somber approach to Del Sol. Also,
Marshall,
could use a bit of advice, really.
Oh, fallen low indeed. If you approach one such as me for advice, I let the wicked assist you where you need them to find. Sure, Marshall, what can I do you for?
Only see that people are already jumping at ghosts right now. And I don't think that's what it is, really. I think just a mighty fine accident just happened outside of town where people got run off the road. And then Graves went and got himself shot. Don't we even remember half of much of what's going on with all of us? Pretty much looks right through me.
I understand you are burdened by a great deal of circumstances, Marshal. I can help where I can if you can indeed pardon the fact that my state is not up to par.
I can always trust you to be honest with me, and that's all I really need.
Go ahead and roll with sensitivity as you consult Del Sol.
Not bad, not bad. That is a 7.
Right. Del Sol will give you a clue. He kind of like stands up a little bit, like leans against the wall for support, takes a moment where his eyes unfocus and refocus as he seems overcome by a dizzy spell, kind of like stumbles a little to the bars of the cell, kind of like hold him up and goes,
"Well, you ever been across the river, Marshal? Out west of here, across the territories into the Chihuahuan Desert?"
Can't say I've gone that far.
Yeah. They call that land Degoya. They got birds out there that they don't got on this side of the river. Chihuahuan ravens. Big birds. Sometimes, though, they do cross and fly over to our El Paso side. I once saw a Chihuahuan raven, I think, picking at a bright red ribbon tangled up in the weeds. I think I remember a story somewhere about that being an omen of some kind, but I apologize, Marshal. My mind is not presently what it once was, nor will it become again, but I will do my best. I hope that helps.
Maybe it'll help in due time.
Oh, due time. I know a lot about due time, and sometimes time is never due early enough, if you catch my meaning. Ripples and eddies, sir. Ripples and eddies.
And very good. Very good. Let's wrap up the day phase. Was there any other action, Daniel, you were particularly thinking about taking, or are we mostly resolving, or mostly just saying that was Arkansas's day phase stuff?
Yeah, and he's just going to, so for the night phase, he's going to that bar, Neil's.
Cool. So then, all right.
Yeah, he didn't have to do it in the daytime.
Yeah, I feel like that was a pretty well-rounded day phase. All right. Then before we end the session, we are going to... we're going to resolve the dusk phase, and then we'll go to stars and wishes, and then we can do next session with start the night phase off. So dusk phase procedure. Marshall, are you intending to do an assembly tonight in El Paso?
Because it's funny to do so immediately. Yes.
Very good. You may call an assemblage during the dusk phase. Fantastic. Then we will go through the process of discussing what that move does and the setup for it next session. Just on the table now, there is an assembly being held. Funny that you're doing that in the first session. I kind of love that. Very good. Let's see here. All right. Other thing I got to do that we're going to do now is I'm going to pose a paint the scene question about the Wounded Knight of El Paso to establish some effects it has on the land. Let's take a look at the Wounded Knight tab here. I'm going to pick, let's see. I mean, fittingly enough, let's do the first one, the Children of El Paso. In what ways are the Children of El Paso already more naturally sensitive to the supernatural realm, subtly affected by the Wounded Knight?
When Knight actually draws open, like, the children, like, typically when they get waken up by nightmares, they go to their parents' rooms and whatnot. But when, like, the parents look at their children, they see that their eyes reflect the glow of the moon.
Only children can see in mirrors. Maybe it's a specific type of lead line mirror that they can see reflections of spirits.
Every child has an imaginary friend.
Every child hears at least one secret whispered from the other plane. Sometimes they tell their parents. Sometimes they don't.
Very good. Now, you have 6 clues for the Lady in White already. We got really easy with the clues this time around. Do you all want to answer that next session? Take a stab at that now? Or are you going to hold off on that until like maybe you investigate it a bit more? I wouldn't fault you for taking more time on it either, because I understand that like we've barely dipped our toe in the water on it, and already we've gotten so many clues. But again, ultimately your call. If you guys feel the yearn to theorize already, be my guest. Otherwise, we can hold off.
I would like a few more clues, because currently it would be a flat roll.
Mm-hmm. Sure. All right, no worries then. Then in that case, next session, we will establish what our various hunters are going to be doing during this upcoming night phase if they're not attending the assembly, and we will introduce our first unseen for the night phase and then see what happens. Just so we don't forget, between sessions here, even though the Dawn question experience doesn't happen yet, go ahead and take a look at your role-playing prompt. See if any of you guys feel like you did those this session. If you did, go ahead and mark them just to remind yourself that you did that. And then we'll get to that during the Dawn phase next time. And yeah, let's go to Stars and Wishes, everybody. We've done our first little session of Ghost of El Paso. So whoever wishes to kick things off, be my guest.
All right, I'll go. I'm always, I want to yell about how fabulous everyone is all the time, 24/7. It takes effort to not do it in the middle of a session. So we're going to do it now. Oh my gosh, Alex, what a cool way to start a game. Oh my gosh, this cinematic prologue, the way that you had us introduce like items in the dwellings, that is so cool. Absolutely fabulous. I love your voice for Del Sol as well. I'm kind of obsessed, just like a little bit. Just a little bit. Oh my gosh. Just amazing. 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 Arkansas McGee is hilarious. I love him so much already. I love the backstory with the Blackheart Vermilion is already so salient and so ever present with this person. And we've only played one session. I love it. Also, thank you for getting in full cowboy gear with me, Daniel. I appreciate it. Ruth Calvo is... your Dutch accent is astounding. I love it. I love her whole vibe. The fact that you just like have these sermons and prayers just on lock already is so good. She's so fully fleshed out. I love that the first time you use this fire and brimstone move was on... literal children. Yeah, no, she's delightful. I love her. I'm so excited to see more. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Mr. Andrew Harrington, what are you up to? You're so suspicious. I love it. I love that you're suspicious. I love that you have a secret friend who no one else can see, a fun little imaginary friend man. That's bananas. I really love that the petty theft device is very funny. That was really fun. It was really, really lovely always to get to do a scene with you. That's a very fun intro to these two, I would say, total weirdos having a very bizarre conversation. What a great way to start this burgeoning friendship with death. So yeah, stars all around. Oh my gosh, just... And all of the items y'all did were so cool, and all of the paint the scenes are so cool. So just delicious, 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 every single one of you.
I've got some I've written down here. Following up on the personal items, chaotic. My favorite was the manifested little black book for the inevitable of all those who are about to die or maybe who have died. I love that's my favorite. I've got a suspicion as to what's up with Mr. Harrington, and I might write it down and post it somewhere so then I can reveal it later if I was on target. I won't say what it is now, but I think I'm going to write it down. for Alex, yeah, I really like the how you set this up. I like your Doc Albers. Metallurgy is one of my enthusiasms. And I like that your reaction to Wes. Are you invoking fire and brimstone? That was good. And then as Deputy Wainwright, when the Inevitable said this happens all the time, does it? That was a good reaction. So big star there for Alex. For Wes, I like how like not B. Arthur, but kind of is she being judgmental? Is she like, does she know who I am? Listen up, you hellions and all that. Collecting or looting, like expecting the worst from humanity. But and I got a big star here for your prayer for the marshal at the beginning. That was really good. And for B, I've got your initial incoherent revelations were really cool. And then when you switched, I've never seen anybody play death like you're playing death. Like to me, your death is like a cat, you know, stalking the night. And some other versions of death I've seen, everybody takes a different take, but yours is very interesting. Learning how to eat and all that was really good. So big stars. Wishes, I'm going to Niels.
Yeah, I gotta give a star for everyone's characters. They seems so very interesting, and like you know exactly why they are all on the same team, but even though that they really shouldn't get along with each other for the most part, I've been sort of sprinkling in ideas of like, okay, like this is how Mr. Harrington keeps the group together reasonably. Mother Ruth is like all ready for justice, where Mr. McGee is just like, yeah, I need to have witnesses here so people don't think I'm robbing them. And Graves, like I have an idea of like how Bartholomew relates to Mr. Harrington and why like Mr. Harrington's just like kind of sad that Bartholomew doesn't remember him like really all that much, and it's just like a kind of like a little sad, and just like it's just like, but he keeps on denying it. It's like anything supernatural when he should know better.
Also, feel free, I'm going to say this to all of you, Chaotic and everyone, if you have an idea about Bartholomew, it's canon. I will not deny anything you all make up about this dude. Godspeed to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm looking forward to hearing what Daniel's theory about my character is. I really want to know it now, but I will not confirm anything, because I have a very firm idea of what's the deal with Mr. Harrington. And I'm looking forward to revealing that, much to maybe Alex's own dismay of like, what are you doing with this character? Why did you make him so weird? And I'm like, because I can. Because I love the system, and I love being self-referential and indulgent and whatnot. But I'm looking forward to having the assembly, the assemblage. I know how to. I'm a filthy min-maxer, so like I know like you want to get the assemblage as often as you can out during when you have very few threats on the board, because the less threats you have to write down, the more you can use the move. So. It's very powerful, and I love it.
Yeah, I want to give stars to. Well, first, before this, a little bit of just to hammer home that that fucking sermon stuff you were talking about. B, having those sermons due to my religious trauma, I have something prepared that I'll have for us every single time. Let us remember what Isaiah said on chapter 8, verse 19. When someone tells you to consult mediums and spiritists who whisper and mutter, should not a people inquire of their God? Why consult the dead on behalf of the living? So let that sit and think about that. I want to give stars to B playing inevitable like this. This whole kind of like experiences and everything like that. The coffee scene and everything that little scene was great. The vulnerable scene right out of the gate with Harrington was fantastic stuff on both of you. I love the vibe of Harrington. Chaotic. It's very because I guess everybody kind of comes into this trying to play the Marshall like Bullock. And you're not playing the Marshall like Bullock. You're playing the Marshall like how you are playing with like somebody that's like, I'm not from around here, but you know, I've kind of just been thrusted into this position. It feels pretty great. I imagine like a Tim Roth kind of actor is playing Harrington, and I think it's very fitting. Like Tim Roth and 10 Star almost, but with that British accent. Daniel, fantastic work with the Calamity. One of my favorite characters from Deadwood, and you've put such an interesting spin. I can see this old regular that I had at the bar that I used to work at as a late night bar. We called him Hellrod because his last name was Elrod, and he had a long wispy wizard beard and long hair, and he would fall asleep at the bar and he would randomly wake up and have like little musings of wisdom to share with random people and then go back to sleep. So it's like it's really cool to kind of see shades of that, even though you've never met this man before. It's pretty great. Also, Alex, the alternate beginning, the prologue for this game, it's excellent because like I always like playing CFB games with different keepers because to see what kind of spins that they put on the things. Like Jason is so very concise and direct and mechanical with everything, and you can tell that he's had a hand in creating the system. But with you, you're like me. You have a sense of like cinematography about things, and you have like it's almost like you're opening up one of those Old West volume books that they used to have. I can't remember who sold them, but there's like brown leather bound books. It was like Tales of the West, and they have different. Is Daniel about to pull out one of them or a bunch of them? I'm probably. Yeah. But like it's almost like opening that up and like, yes, that is exactly the book that I'm thinking about. I love those books. I've been trying to find copies of them everywhere. But like, yeah, no, it's fantastic stuff. I love Westerns so much, and like it's such a fantastic group of people to play this. So this is fantastic. Wishes. I can't wait to see some of our hunters on their knees in prayer soon. And I want to see more of these vices spread out. I want to see how these vulnerable moves play out with these vices, because I think we have some interesting characters to play with them. So yeah, stars to all of you. Wishes. I'm feeling great.
Wes, could you say out what Mother Ruth's vice is?
I think we'll see in time. I think you can all check and see, but I think for everybody at home, they'll see exactly what Mother Ruth's vice is. Uh-huh.
Yeah. This was a lot of fun. This was a great session. I love Ghosts of El Paso thematically and mechanically. I love the between, but honestly, between like the between pun, basic, you know, OG between in Victorian London and Ghosts of El Paso. I love both. I really love Ghosts of El Paso just because as a setting, I am such a like fan of like Deadwood and other Westerns. I have so much fun role-playing characters in a Western and presenting this kind of world. You know, obviously, for one, it's a bit closer to my own personal like lived experiences, having for a significant part of my life grown up out in Colorado, which is the hub of the West back of old Western history. And yeah, but I love bringing this world to life. I love these characters so much already. I knew that I could trust you guys with breaking the typical presentation and structure for introducing characters to do something a bit more cinematic, to lean a bit more into this narrative. And I'm glad I did, because it felt really satisfying in play and really kind of gave me a grasp on the way you guys wanted to play these characters and kind of like the sensibilities and maybe like what kind of directions they might, you know, get pointed in. That was really cool. I really loved the first initial words between Graves and Mother Calvo, with quoting from Revelation. And I loved the quote saying, you know, near enough to hell, that I'm like, do we just call this campaign near enough to hell? I'm thinking the answer is yes, because everyone seemed to vibe pretty hardcore with that in the chat. So I don't know, maybe you'll see this as near enough to hell, a Ghost of El Paso story. I think that has a nice ring to it. Wes, star for Mother Calvo's sermon at the very start of the Marshall, as was already said, that was really fantastic, very cinematic and somber. And I feel like it set the tone, not just for Mother Calvo very well, but also this kind of underlying tension with Harrington's character and possibly relating to Harrington's past. I mean, B, the voice for Graves, the demeanor you present him with is so, as was already mentioned, cat-like. There's something sinister but not overtly hostile about it. I am a big fan of death as presented in Terry Pratchett's Discworld series. And this isn't like quite that, but like it has that similar kind of like inhuman humanity, you know what I mean, of just being like this kind of somewhat ominous curiosity. And I really enjoyed those interactions with Harrington, and your conversation with the deputy. I love role-playing Del Sol self-star. Let's see, Daniel, I really like the Calamity as a playbook so far from what I've read, and just kind of seeing the vibes that you're presenting. This like touch of eccentricities mixed with this inner darkness that we barely touch on, but we kind of got a little bit glimpses of here and there. I like that a lot. I'm excited to see where that playbook goes. Overall, just really solid stuff from you guys, as I've expected over the course of White Mountain Rescue. I'm so stoked to begin playing Ghost of El Paso with you guys. Wishes, I could have presented the first mastermind clue, or, you know, encouraged someone to bump up a roll to get it this session. But I figured, you know what? We'll get it when we get it. I want to see that one arrive solely through the dice, if you guys choose to embrace it or not, because I like the mastermind in this, or masterminds I should say, in Ghost of El Paso, so I'm excited to see that come into the play. I really love the setting of El Paso, and I felt like we were already embracing it, especially because we kind of made note of pre-existing locations. You guys started to pull from those for your roleplay. I thought that was great, so I'm excited to continue to see the setting like fill out more and kind of form this communal familiarity with it. I'm always wanting to see more vulnerable scenes between our hunters, just interactions in general. And once we begin to, because since this is B's first time with the between, as you know, the system, I'm always looking forward to getting to kind of experience the between stuff, like the unseen as it is intended in this circumstance, and also stacking up all the threats, obviously. So I'm excited for more threats. I think that's all I had in mind. Does anyone else have any other lingering stars or wishes?
I'm looking forward to how B is going to react when we start to have a full plate with Ghosts of El Paso. Because instead of White Mountain Rescue, where it's one mystery at a time, we're going to have three on the board. At least.
God damn!
Well, we've played Silver Versus. So.
Yeah, I've played Silver Versus. It's kind of wild. My wish is I definitely want to see more. I'm very excited for everyone's Masks of the Past. I want to hear you all narrate stuff. I loved your ones in White Mountain Rescue. I'm super excited to hear how you narrate these characters' backstories. That's my wish. Is I know that that's me asking for you to fail a role, but like, you know.
Awesome. Any others? All right, then let us wave goodbye on the recording, and I will see you guys next time.